The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we thank them for that support. Last week, I read to you On Common Ground, when members of the Choctaw Nation heard about a tragedy half a world away, they didn't hesitate to help. The Irish never forgot their generosity. Some 175 years later, the bonds remain. We weren't quite able to finish, and so I'm going to pick up a little bit before we where we ended up last time. West regards the famine gift as a perfect example of Choctaw values. Compassion, giving, making sure everyone is well, West says. That, to me, is what being Choctaw is. My grandmother was constantly offering food, checking that people had enough to eat. The gift also reminds West of a traditional Choctaw story. Two hungry men go out hunting, and at the end of the day, all they have is one scrawny bird. They hear a woman wailing and go to her. I'm hungry, she says. Can you give me what you have? They give her the bird. In return, she gives them a gift of corn, which becomes a staple food for the Choctaw. Academically, both scholars thrived in Ireland. Young, in the museum studies program, helped curate an exhibition for the Cork Public Museum before a summer work placement at the National Museum of Denmark's North America Ethnographic Collection in Copenhagen. That's a mouthful. West had a steep learning curve when it came to Irish political science. I didn't know anything about the Taoiseach Prime Minister or the Houses of Parliament, but received high grades and worked a summer internship at the American Chamber of Commerce in Ireland. The two scholars had taken great pleasure in exploring this old city of bridges, riverwalks, pubs, and churches, and eating almond croissants in the 18th century covered market. West and Young have taken trips together to Blarney Castle, the Cliffs of Moher, and nearby Middleton, where the Irish-Choctaw relationship is memorialized in a sculpture by the Irish artist Alex Pentek. Dominating a small park by a river estuary in Middleton, gleaming in the sunshine are 9 stainless steel eagle feathers, 20 feet high, and arranged in the shape of a bowl. The name of the sculpture is Kindred Spirits, and it represents the gift of a bowl of food. When I come here, especially with Claire, it's very reassuring, says West. It's a feeling of, oh, I'm still connected. I'm not separated from my people in this unknown country. The phrase kindred spirits is also used by White Deer, who embodies the Choctaw-Irish relationship as much as anyone. He has visited Ireland 17 times and was honored to be received by Mary Robinson when she was president of Ireland at the official residence in Phoenix Park. We had tea, and she thanked the Choctaw people on behalf of Ireland through me, he says. He recently spent 8 consecutive years in Ireland, living in Dublin and County Donegal, painting, writing as autobiography, leading commemorative famine walks, and learning some of the Irish language. Returning home to Ada, Oklahoma in 2020, he found that his small wood-frame 1940s house had deteriorated from storm damage. Then in 2021, a huge winter storm finished off the plumbing in the roof and left holes in the floor. I was recovering from a heart procedure and didn't have running water, he says. I applied for home repair assistance to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Choctaw Nation, and the Chickasaw Nation. They all turned me down. When Mullen found out, he immediately started a GoFundMe campaign for white deer and publicized it across Irish media and social media. The campaign raised 17,000 euro in the first year, enabling white deer to pay for a new roof, partially repair the plumbing, and repair the floor. All thanks to the people of Ireland, he says. Further donations enabled him to complete repairs on the plumbing and the gas heater system and winterize the property. White Deer has illustrated his thoughts and feelings about the Choctaw Famine Gift in a painting titled An Arrow Shot Through Time. I heard that phrase from one of our elders, referring to a lost arrow that had been shot many years before and landed in the future, he says. I applied it to the famine gift story. We've come to the place where the arrow landed. We have it in our hands again, and we can move forward with it. It's a story that belongs to everyone, not just the Irish and Choctaw people. It's about the power of compassion and generosity. And up next, on a lighter note, Nectar of the Gods, how one of the world's oldest alcoholic beverages could become the drink of the future. It's almost certainly 5 o'clock somewhere, but when I find my way to Baltimore's Charm City Mead Works on a Tuesday in May, it is the sober hour of 1 p.m. Out front is a welcoming plot of grass, picnic tables, and arranged beneath a tarpaulin and a bench orienting visitors with the slogan, Baltimore, the city that meads, M-E-A-D-S, a sly reference to the 1988 citywide campaign to fight illiteracy. Inside, a painting of a giant bee hovering about three hives with barroom-style tap handles. Plugged into them leads an element of whimsy to what is otherwise fluorescent-lit industrial space. A person-sized teddy bear in a yellow and black bee-striped T-shirt, sunglasses, and a fedora slumps in a chair, looking like it's sleeping off last night's revels. Off to the side, a tattooed woman with a nose ring is using a forklift to stack pallets. A low shelf holds an inviting selection of board games. One boundary of the tap room, really just a small section of the site set aside for the mead makers to do their work. The man who emerges to greet me is Charm City co-founder James Boycourt, B-O-I-C-O-U-R-T, a solidly built, bearded, ball-cap-wearing 40-year-old, whose tired eyes peg him as either a small business owner, the father of young children, or both. It's option C, it turns out. He's got a 3-year-old daughter and another who's 6 months old, and there's something paternal in the way he talks about his business, too. Exhaustion and pride come through in equal measure. Since Charm City's founding 9 years ago, he tells me, it has become one of the nation's top 4 or 5 producers of mead, the ancient libation, the ancient libation made from mixing honey with water and yeast. I'm saying that very conservatively by volume, Boycourt adds. Mead is believed to be the world's oldest alcoholic refreshment, possibly predating the advent of beer and wine, not by centuries, but by 3 or 4 millennia. Researchers in China have found evidence of the beverage inside 9,000-year-old jars, according to Fred Minnick, author of Mead, The Libations, Legends, and Lore of History's Oldest Drink. As with many of history's great innovations, it probably came about by accident. The first time a beehive got flooded by rainwater, there was naturally occurring mead. Greg Heller LaBelle, president of the American Mead Makers Association, told me. Every single human civilization has had some permutation of mead. Gradually, beer and wine displaced it, not least because grain and grapes are on the whole less expensive to source than honey. There's no single explanation for mead's dramatic reemergence over the last decade or so, but a renewed cultural interest in Norse mythology and of fantasy stories derived from it is likely to be a contributing factor. If you want to credit Game of Thrones, HBO's hugely popular series, adapted from George R.R. Martin's fantasy novels, in which characters enjoy a ceremonial horn of mead, the timing works out. The show first aired in April 2011, when the number of commercial meaderies operating in the United States was shy of 200. Today, there are at least 480. Until this year, Heller LaBelle was CEO of Colony Meadery in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which he co-founded in 2013. We thought our market was beer people, but it turned out our best customers were ones who don't like other forms of alcohol, he says. Because beer is too bitter for them, wine too acidic, and cider, on a mass scale, too sweet. Mead is such a versatile beverage, and frankly, it can be made so that it doesn't taste like alcohol. Boyquart was already homebrewing beer as an undergraduate at North Carolina State University, where he was studying engineering and political science, when he enrolled in a popular course called Introduction to the Honeybee and Beekeeping as a way to fulfill a biology requirement. I got so interested in the beekeeping side that I almost ended up graduating with an entomology minor, he says. Before long, he had more honey than he knew what to do with. What's a college student going to do with some yeast and some fermentable stuff? They're going to figure out a way to make booze. After he graduated in 2006, he spent a few years as an engineer, helping a cable company install fiber optic wires on the seafloor using remotely operated underwater submersibles. But the work eventually bored him, and he continued to make mead on the side. In 2014, he and a pal, Andrew Gefkin, gambled that the boom in craft brewing and an increased consumer appetite for locally sourced natural food and drink had created ripe conditions to make mead the next frontier in fancy libations, and they founded Charm City. Gefkin has since scaled back his involvement, but he still holds a small stake in the company. People had treated mead as more of a novelty beverage, something you might have at a Renaissance fair or a special occasion. Boyquart says, "Our vision was to push something that people would drink every day, making mead that's very approachable, very light, very refreshing." What began as a two-man operation out of Boyquart's kitchen soon required 1,400 square foot warehouse in an industrial area of South Baltimore. They scaled up their current 18,000 square foot flagship Brewery Tap Room in 2017. Today, you can buy their meads from California to Texas to New York at the chain retailer Total Wine and More. But the company's footprint remains largest in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. They go through as much as 10,000 pounds of honey a month, enough to produce 1,200 or so barrels of mead each year. For Boycourt, that's almost good enough. My goal is to get consistently 1,500 barrels a year. After that, ideally, one day you'll be able to go into a Chili's and find next to the cider tap there'll be mead. Charm City's meads aren't as sweet as you might expect. The spectrum from dry to semi-sweet to sweet mead is at least as wide as you can find in beer or wine. But the essential character of a mead is defined first and foremost by the honey used as a base. A lot of people's perception of honey is that it just tastes like honey, and that it's sweet, Boycourt says. But honey is quite variable. Honey from two neighboring beehives will taste different from each other, even if the honey is of the same type, so long as the bees are foraging from different plants. A lot of the ephemeral volatile compounds that help a flower smell also help honey taste different, he says. So you'll come up with honeys that taste like marshmallows, or others that are darker and have fig or plum or date notes. You'll have honeys that are really floral, some that are herbal, and that's where our process starts. That reliance on honey makes batches of mead trickier to standardize than other beverages. Mead makers talk about mead having a distinctive terroir in a way that beer really doesn't have, or you can't have it as immediately, says Teresa McCullough, curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Brewers can use malted grains or hops from all over the world and even play with the different kind of water that they're brewing with, tweaking the pH to make it taste a certain way. Whereas the honey that a mead maker uses is very much of a particular place, often of a place that's very close to where that mead maker is working. Charm City sources most of its honey from a supplier in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and a company called World Honey Exchange to import varietal and regional honeys from abroad. Boycourt himself, a master beekeeper, still maintains a few hives at what he terms the hobby level, but nothing on the scale that would produce the quantities Charm City requires to keep the taps flowing. But he remains something of a bee romantic, hopes to incorporate an observation hive into Charm City's future offerings. We'll have the entrance for the bees far enough away from the door that people can't really cross paths with them, he assures. It's part of a larger plan to make Charm City a gathering place not only for families and beverage enthusiasts, but also for beekeeping organizations and others who are bee curious, a chance to provide an educational component to the tap room. He recently acquired a trove of historical beekeeping gear, some of it dating to the 1800s, and he's keen to find a way to display the treasures, along with other visual materials, to help visitors get a sense of the beekeeping entails and how the practice has evolved. The equipment is on display for the public, but there's no missing the fermentation area, including, just past the taproom bar, 7 stainless steel tanks that each hold between 900 and 1,200 gallons, all filled with a base mixture of honey, water, and yeast. That's where the magic happens. Boycourt says. The yeast will actually eat all the sugar in the honey and become mead over the course of a week. The whole process from original mixture to packaging takes 2 to 4 weeks, or a little longer for varieties that will age briefly in oak barrels. Charms City makes about a dozen varieties of mead at any given time, though it's constantly shuffling the lineup with seasonal and limited edition releases. There are carbonated meads served chilled on draft, or in cans with alcohol by volume content similar to beer and stilled meads, which are uncarbonated and more potent like wine. We use a wildflower honey and a base ingredient, and then we'll use specialty honeys to work our way into more interesting flavor profiles, Boycourt says. Then, depending on the product, we'll add a series of other ingredients, fruits, spices, and other honeys. Indeed, the potential variations are effectively without limit. Modern meads typically fall under one of four categories: traditional fruit, spiced, and specialty, each of which then further sorted. Fruit meads feature some of the most exotic names. Cyser, C-Y-S-E-R, is mead fermented with apples. Piment, P-Y-M-E-N-T, is fermented with grapes. Melomel refers to mead made using other fruits. That's M-E-L-O-M-E-L. It's in the spice category that the bold find their herb and vegetable meads, such as an avocado cacao, a prize winner at the 2022 Maser Cup International Mead Competition. Specialty meads include Braggot, B-R-A-G-G-O-T, historical, traditional meads of a specific place not belonging to another category, such as Ethiopian Tej, T-E-J, or Polish Trojanik, T-R-O-J-N-I-A-K, and experimental, which can be anything included in this category in mead maker Robert Ratcliffe's 2017 Big Book of Mead Recipes, are instructions for flavors like blueberry compote, chocolate maple, bacon bochette, B-O-C-H-E-T, and peanut butter and jelly. Despite its prodigious success, Charm City remains a small operation. Boycourt has only 8 full-time employees, plus a couple of dozen part-timers staffing the tap room. The division of labor is accordingly fluid. The woman operating the forklift when I arrived, Lynn Pronobis, turns out to be Charm City's head mead maker. I made my way over to the bar with Boycourt and Pronobis for tasting. Pronobis is wearing a Charm City T-shirt. She has a background in chemistry and planned to be a doctor before finding her way into the craft brewing scene. After working at a hospital, she told me, I was like, this is not the environment I want to be in. As we chat, another mead maker, Matt Frager, comes over repeatedly asking Pronobis to sip an in-progress beverage. She tastes, reflects, and offers feedback that sends him back to his workstation. We're just trying to dial in the flavor, she says, discussing the finish of it, the sugar level, the pH, things like that. It's a balancing act, Boycourt says. Mead makers have to prevent sulfurous compounds that can leave eggy or burnt match notes, flavors that in beer you can hide behind malt. The first offering Boycourt sets out is called Mead is Murder, rounded out with a poetic serenade of dragon fruit. This citrusy session mead lands with a flavor profile that pairs well with this iconic album, a sly pun on a rock album by the Smiths. But the one I like best is an entry-level carbonated mead called Saltbox Sunrise, a fruited sour gussied up with mango and pineapple, some of Charm City's most reliable sellers. I learned, don't taste all that boozy. There's elderberry. Cheers to the fruit you'd rather drink than eat. Basil, lemongrass, ultra dry, uniquely refreshing. Wildflower, floral and crisp, like a dry white wine. And out of left field, a crushed orange, wildflower honey, lemon lime twist that goes down very easy. For my last tasting, I try one of the still meads, a black currant red raspberry, dry and fruity, but not sweet. That one goes down nicely. It's very easy to make a refreshing mead that's like 10 or 12%, and all of a sudden the party goes to places you were not prepared for, says Boycourt, laughing. As by now, it's edging closer to 5 o'clock. With Boycourt's warning in mind and a 75-minute drive home down I-95 ahead of me, I swish the blackcurrant red raspberry mead around in my mouth for a few pleasurable seconds and spit it back out. But I look forward to enjoying a bottle of it at home when I need not exhibit so much caution. Boycourt can count another convert in a campaign to which he's dedicated a decade of his life. Before I depart, as he hands me a 4-pack of the Saltbox Sunrise, Boycourt pauses to admire the whimsical street scene painted on the cans. The colorful artwork features pigeons, a cat, a flamingo, and even a rat using a straw to drink out of a pineapple. To Boycourt, the chaos suits a beverage he makes with tremendous skill, but without the kind of uniformity of more ubiquitous drinks. There's a science to it, but also there's a lot of art. And that's going to wrap up this episode of Smithsonian. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, you may call us anytime at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.